Good morning. So last time we talked about IBCM and how you might go about writing useful-ish IBCM code. We started off with some format advice. So our advice, which you've probably hopefully done as you started the pre-lab, is that the first column has to be machine code because that's how our simulator works. But after that, we recommend like putting the address because you need to resolve labels and we're going to do that by hand, the assembly and some comments so both you and we can figure out what you were trying to do, especially if something doesn't quite work. And our suggested process is to start by writing some pseudocode, like I've shown, translate that to assembly, and then translate that assembly to machine code, especially doing last, ideally, the operation of resolving all your labels, so you don't have to change all the addresses in your code when you figure out that you forgot something that hopefully you could figure out from the assembly, though of course that won't always happen. And we talked about some useful assembly patterns for handling control constructs, where it seems like if you look at the IBCM assembly language, well, we don't have like something which is an if, really, where you specify a block of code to run, so you have to make that up in terms of the conditional jump we have. We don't have like a loop construct, you have to make that up in terms of the conditional jumps we have. We also looked at an example of how you do something like a pointer access. And the basic idea is that you're going to have this placeholder later on in the code you execute, and you're going to replace that with an instruction that accesses the pointer you had. So you get the pointer in your accumulator, use it to form an instruction, you write that instruction to code you're eventually going to run, and that accesses using that pointer. Yes?
Can you go over that last point just a little bit more? What the code actually looks like?
Yes, I will do that in a second.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to start off by reviewing useful patterns and we'll get to the pointer ones first. So first we'll talk about sort of if and while. So for if, we have a few different instructions for ifs and whiles to make them. One of them is jump L, which is if the accumulator is less than zero, then do something. So here, which is what we just loaded in the accumulator, is less than zero, we're going to jump ahead to S1, which, to save myself a little bit of code, I put in the wrong order here. You don't have to do that if you add a couple more jumps. And if that doesn't happen, we end up executing S2, and then we jump ahead to skip S1. We also have, which I'm not showing in this example, jump E, which is if the accumulator equals zero. So what you do if x equals zero was the case in your pseudocode and not x less than zero. And for a loop, we start off by setting up an unconditional jump, usually to go back to the top of the loop. That's what I've been doing. This is not the only way of doing that. And then we have to check our condition. So we load x and we test, is x less than zero like before? And if so, we go out of the loop. We have a jump which gets out of that infinite loop we'd have if we just had jump top, something jump top. We just keep going around and around, and that jump L lets us escape the loop and go to the statement afterwards. So let's talk about what we're doing with our pointer accesses. So here, my pseudocode is I have a p is some variable which contains an address, and I want to store to the address contained in p. So I'm going to set up this template here. So here, this is the opcode for store. Store, which means that this whole thing here is the instruction store into address 0. So you start off with store into address 0, and we want to change that to be store into the address stored in P. And it happens that we've chosen our encoding in IBCM, so the address is the lower bits of the instruction, so we can just add to that to do that. So if we add 1, it would turn it from store 0 to store 1, store into address 1. If we added 2, return it to store 2. So we just want to add the quantity P. P is a number indicating a memory location. We want to add that to that instruction, and that will turn it into a store whatever the number was in P instruction. So if P contains, say, 16, we turn it to store 16. So we start off with our with store 0, and we end up with the accumulator containing the store star P instruction. This is the contained address, not like the address where P is. The address inside, the number inside P. So that's what's in our accumulator here, and when we store that in here, so we've replaced our placeholder here, which I just made FFFF because I don't care what it is. Maybe if I was thinking about it, probably the choice, best choice would be something with opcode 0, so my program halts if I accidentally go there without storing something. And we replace that with our store star P instruction we wrote in our accumulator. And just be, so now we have store star P at this part of the program. We wanted to store X there, so we load X into the accumulator, and then we run this store star P instruction. So I should say this is P's value. Similarly, if we want to add the value stored at star P, we're going to construct not a store instruction, but an add instruction. Because remember, our add instruction takes a memory address as its argument. So we're going to start off with add 0, and we're going to turn it into add star P. So we have our template here where we have the opcode for add, and this whole thing is add 0. The beginning here was just the opcode for add. And we end up with our accumulator containing add star P, which we again store in this template. So then we actually do our math operation, so we load X in this case, we add star P to it, and then we store it back in its in X from the accumulator. So this just general pattern is you take whatever instruction you want to do with star P, so pointer, and then you load the instruction template, you add the pointer which you have stored somewhere to it, and you store the instruction template in your placeholder location. And then later on, you let your code reach that placeholder location naturally, just by keeping going to PC++1 and so on. And this is how we're going to do any type of pointer operation, because we don't have an instruction which does something like use the accumulator as a pointer and load that memory location directly. So questions about this, since I'm sure it's probably still confusing. Yes?
So is do it just initialize to like an arbitrary zero?
Yes. So the number I've initialized do it to, question is that arbitrary? Yes. Okay. So ideally, you'd want to choose a number where you'd find out if you made a mistake. So probably FFFFF actually isn't the best choice. Probably something that starts with the opcode 0 would be the best choice, because that means your program will halt if you accidentally forget to store something there. Because the policy is we better have stored something there, or else, you know, we're not doing what we're trying to do by the time we actually execute it. So other questions? Okay. And if you remember, the other example we had of this was in our translation of ArraySum, where we did exactly the pattern I showed you earlier with for doing an addition, except here, you know, we construct our pointer as a plus I is our pointer. So we add twice. We could have also like computed a plus I, stored it in some variable p, look, and then added p. That's equivalent to what this is doing here. They just did a shorthand of not actually constructing that pointer p. They just added a and I in the accumulator along with the instruction. So that's probably all I plan on saying explicitly about the details of writing IBCMs, because I hope you're prepared enough for the lab this week and we can move on to other topics. I'm going to have some sort of closing miscellaneous topics about what IBCM can do and sort of its design generally and how that fits in with other types of machines you might have. So one of the key things we want to get across with IBCM, and I guess the pedagogical justification for having you have do this weird trick to access pointers, which when you use x86, you're not going to do that. In fact, it's on the x86 machines, it's actually a pretty bad idea to try to write instructions and then execute them right away most of the time. But is that code and data are the same sort of thing, that we have this one memory, and this is how our modern TIP machines typically work, where we just have a bunch of values, and it could be code or it could be data, and the only way we know which is which is by knowing what is our machine trying to do. If it's trying to load something based on the PC, well, it must be code. If it's trying to load something because you have a load instruction, it must be data. Is sort of your notion. And obviously these can mix when you write a program that writes code, like we saw some examples for doing our pointer accesses, and obviously like your compiler does that. And there's a name term for this, a von Neumann architecture. So this is the design where we have one single memory, which is code and data. There's an alternate design known as Harvard architecture where you don't do that, where you have to do something special to somehow turn data into code. And both are real things that are used, but you know, there's an attractiveness of having this all together in that compilers aren't really as special as they would be. But they're just doing something that you could do anyways. So as far as things IBCM can do, we have a very limited instruction set, and it might seem like, therefore, that the programs you can write are, you know, there's not actually that much you can do. So in a formal sense, this isn't true. So if you take 3102, you'll learn like formally what this means. But IBCM, in some formal sense, can compute anything. So it's Turing complete if we extend it to an infinitely large memory. So obviously, we can't actually compute everything because we only have so much memory. But you can say this of any computer. You can say, my laptop can't compute everything, because I only have like, you know, so many hundreds of gigabytes of storage. So if I went to computer number, which is bigger than that, I can't do it. And yes, that's true, but that's not usually what we want to think about when we ask whether something is sort of lets you do anything you want to do. So if we extend IBCM to an infinitely large memory in any logical way, we'll find out that it can, in some formal sense, compute any function you can think of. Okay. Yes, and as a reminder before we leave this topic, so sort of the general notions of how you write it. So we said pseudocode to assembly code to machine code. And really probably a good idea, but maybe it's too late for those of you who didn't do that. And generally, as far as things you can get wrong, make sure you check your program logic. In particular, there's jump L and jump B. And it's easy to get mixed up on whether like you wrote jump L, but you really want jump less than or equal or jump greater than, which we don't have, but you can move things around. And that's a common thing to get wrong, and it's pretty subtle when you're looking at assembly code. Also, another thing that's pretty common to get wrong is you can make some mistake in your machine code translation, like get an opcode wrong, or write the wrong value for a label, or change where a label is, not update everything. And that's, so the simulator's not doing what you expect, you probably should double check that. Okay, so even though IBCM can compute anything, some things are exceptionally awkward to do. And we saw one example of this with pointer operations. Pointer operations are pretty awkward to do. There's some things which are really awkward to do, where you might imagine that another instruction set, if you were designing this to actually be useful, we'd add some operations. For example, multiply and divide. You can absolutely do that in IBCM. You want to do a multiply, you know how to write a loop, you know how to add, you can do it. You want to divide, you know how to write a loop, you know how to subtract, you know how to compare to zero, you can do it. And you can even do it in a faster way, because if you think about better addition multiplication algorithms like how you do it in base 10. But really, you'd probably like to have some instruction to help you do that. If you want to do floating point, you can implement floating point in IBCM. Would you like to? Probably not, because you have to do it in terms of additions and comparisons and like probably like a bit at a time in some cases, but it's possible. The biggest omission that, of course, we're going to address with XC6 is that, you know, you don't have much storage. You don't have big addresses. You don't have big values. 16-bit values are rather limited. You can, like, construct bigger values from them, but it's pretty awkward. Like, you can work with a 64-bit number as four 16-bit chunks, but that's not very fun to do. We'd like to have more registers because having to move everything in and out of the accumulator is pretty annoying when you are dealing with multiple values. And we'd like to be able to do pointer operations in a less weird way. So let's talk a bit about what our simulators for IBCM look like. And this is something that can generally happen with any simulator. So we have our machine code. Let's say I want to implement that. What does that look like? If I want to implement it not in hardware, but as a program. So like, what is our simulator doing? And the basic pattern that you can use for everything is you just have a big loop and a switch statement. So, you know, while we're not done, we have this array representing our memory, get the value at that location, we extract the I code and have a switch statement. Check the opcode, and that's fairly straightforward. Extracting the opcode is not actually so trivial. So one way of doing it is with the shift operators and the bitwise operators, which we have not talked about. But this shift is basically that shift operation I showed you earlier that exists in C. And this AND is bit by bit AND, so it takes all the one bits in this case, and those are the only bits which are still set in the output. So it makes all the other bits remain at zero. Another thing we could have done is you could say instead do like instruction divided by 250, divided by 4096, which is 2 to the 12th, which is the same thing. If you think about how binary arithmetic works, when the rounding actually works out, that will extract the opcode. And you could have also, you can also encode instructions. So we have an operator which shifts values right, like we showed earlier. So this is the same thing as doing opcode times 4096 and adding the address. Bitwise OR takes each bit and ORs it together. So if the least significant bit is, say, 0 in both of them, the result will be 0. If it's 1 in either of them, the result will be 1. So it's simpler than add because you can think of it as being kind of like saturating add without carry, and is what we canonically do to construct instructions. So C++ and C have support for a bit less awkward extraction of fields, so and manipulation of fields. And this is with something called bit fields, which look something like this. So we can say, I have this union, and remember a union means I'm using the same memory to represent it, and either it's a value, which is 16 bits, or it's this struct called, a bunch of these structs, one of which is called others, which is has a 4-bit field called opcode. This is the number of bits, and a 12-bit field called address. And so this is a special syntax for defining, for saying, I want things of a particular bit width. And if we choose these carefully, you can just say, have a name for the top 4 bits of the value. So later on, we can use something like this. We can say, we have our union, it has this other struct in it. We can say that union.others.op to access the 4-bit opcode, and the compiler will take care of figuring out, how do I get those bits? Do I divide by 4096? Do I do the shifting? It will figure that out for us. So that's just a feature we'll mention briefly. So this is called bit fields. So this is something we can have, sort of, you can think of it as a class where you have numbers which take up a smaller part of the class and are packed into one value rather than being stored as separate bytes. And so it's, each of those is called a bit field. Technically, the order of bits can vary between the compilers, but it happens that Linux sets up the order so this works. The Linux convention for what the order is. There obviously needs to be one because of, like, if you had a library, a .h file, and it put things in a particular order, that better work the same way no matter who's using it. So in that convention on Linux, it works correctly for this use case. And generally, most systems set it up so you can write your bit field in a way which does that. And this is a common thing you'll see people do when they have something laid out in bits like that, usually because it's meant to be interfacing with some sort of hardware. So that's all I have on IBCM related topics. So any questions about IBCM before we move on to x86? Okay, so. So let's talk about x86. So x86, it's hard to get away from history. So we started off in x86 with this old system where we had 8-bit registers, the Intel 8008, 8008, 71, and then there was a successor to that, which was the 8086, and the 802086, and a whole bunch of these, and I'm even omitting some things in between. But they expanded from having 7 8-bit registers to 8 16-bit registers to 8 32-bit registers, and then to 16 64-bit registers. And when they were doing this, they tried to like keep a lot of the machine code and assembly language either the same or very similar. And this explains a lot of why x86 assembly looks as strange as it does. That a lot of the things in it date back to this machine with 7 8-bit registers and the names it had for each of those things. And if you look at the instruction encoding, which we won't because it's really complicated, a lot of the instruction coding is explained by saying, oh, originally this was designed to encode only 16-bit registers, and there were only 8, not 16 of them, and then people added things on, which kept it mostly the same, but let you support extra registers, which means like we store what the register number is in like 2 different places for the same register number, things like that. And so the basic history is we started off with these 16-bit machines in the early 80s, late 70s. Then we had these 32-bit machines up until the 2000s. And that was the dominant thing. And then around 2003, AMD, Intel's competitor, decided that they were going to make a 64-bit version of x86. And Intel quickly played catch up and implemented it themselves in a version of their latest processor. So they had the Pentium 4, which originally was a 32-bit processor, and they made a 64-bit version of it. At the time, Intel did want to make a 64-bit processor. Like, there was a thought that, yes, we need bigger values and addresses. We want to support more than 4 gigs of memory. And if you think 2 to the 32, that's 4 gigs. Hard to support more than 4 gigs of memory with 32-bit pointers, which is what you'd had on with 32-bit registers. That's where you're putting your pointers. But Intel's approach was they were making this new architecture called Itanium at the time. And based on how many of you have heard of Itanium besides here? So you can guess how successful that was. I think still being produced today, but not very successful. And AMD's sort of shoehorning 64-bit registers in x86 is what won. Okay. So we're going to talk about x86 assembly. And unfortunately, I need to talk a bit about syntax issues. So there are 2 very different ways of writing it. x86 assembly. So there's something called AT&T syntax, and this is the default on Linux and OS X almost all the time. There's also something called Intel syntax, which is the default on Windows most of the time. And these have different operand order, different ways of writing addresses, different use of punctuation in the syntax. Like, they're completely different looking. They represent the same things, like an add of ECX and EBX, 2 registers, is the same thing in either one, but they're written in very different ways as far as order of things, punctuation, and so on. We will mostly show Intel syntax, but you should be aware that the other one exists. So if you look at x86 assembly and it looks completely different, there's all these funny symbols you haven't seen, this is probably what's happening. So, yes. Is there a reason we're not using the Linux version? Probably because Bloomfield a while ago decided that he liked the Intel syntax better, which there are good reasons to. We'll be doing assignments using an assembler known as NASM, which does not support the AT&T syntax. So those are probably the 2 big reasons. I would personally prefer to use AT&T syntax for the entirely selfish reason that we use it in 3330, not because I think it's actually better or worse, but that's not what the assignments are set up to do, so I'm going to show you what we're going to use in the assignments. And it's relatively easy to get our compilers to produce either, because it's just a mechanical translation from one to the other. Okay. So we also met, when we talked about IBCM, we had this idea of directives, these things we'd write in assembly language which weren't actually instructions. And these differ between assemblers, even assemblers which nominally use the same flavor of assembly syntax. So for example, we're going to do some assignments, which as I said, with the assembler NASM. Our compiler uses an assembler called GAS for the GNU assembler. And even though these both support Intel syntax, they use different directives, different ways of writing down directives. These are much slighter differences than AT&T versus Intel syntax, but for example, the way of specifying a constant value is going to be, in NASM, you'll use something like, you know, DW1, something like that. In GAS, you'll use 1: dot word 1. So that's notably different. And that's just an unfortunate thing. So if you come across something not working, it might be that the two different assemblers have slightly different notions of how to specify things like constants and labels and things like that. This is never as dramatic as AT&T versus Intel syntax. Okay. So that's some assembly syntax issues. So now we're going to get to the assembly language. I'm going to start with the registers. So in IBCM, we didn't talk much about registers because the only one we could access from assembly was the accumulator, which we never named because, well, every instruction had to use it. There was nowhere else to go. In x86, we have a whole bunch of registers. So I'm going to start with the Intel 8086. So the Intel 8086 had 8 16-bit registers. We have AX, BX, CX, DX, which are our general purpose registers. And we have 4 special purpose registers. BP for base pointer, SI for source index, DI for destination index, and SP for stack pointer. So those special registers, by some instructions, are treated specially. This has happened less and less as x86 has evolved. So originally, x86 had lots of instructions where you needed to use only SI or DI for the instructions. Typically, there's not many of these left that are commonly used today. The instructions still exist, but the commonly used instructions, you know, either have dropped the restriction on what registers you can use, or don't do that. The one big exception is SP, the stack pointer. So we're going to have a common stack on x86. This is a core feature of the processor, and we're going to use this all the time. This is how we're going to implement function calls. This is what we're going to do when we want to store some data temporarily, typically. So there's this stack, which is the processor has special instructions to help us use, push and pop, which use this SP stack pointer register. And the stack pointer is basically the index of our top of our stack. So you'll note that the general purpose registers here are divided into two halves. So our AX register has an AH and an AL. The AL is the lower half of AX and the AH is the upper half. So you can use these as registers, but they're 8-bit registers. And the 8-bit register AL, if you change it, it changes the bottom 8 bits of AX. Like they're actually the same bits. They're just a name for the lower 8 bits of AX. So for example, if you use the instruction add AL comma BL, that will add AL to BL and store the result in AL, the lower 8 bits of AX. Okay. So this was our 16-bit universe registers. And then they decided, oh, 16 bits, that's kind of small. Then it went 32 bits. So they wanted to extend all of these. So they just made them all bigger. So they added these E for extended versions of these registers. So EAX is AX with an extra 16 bits. And AX still exists, it's just the lower 16 bits of this EAX. So if you modify AX, that's the lower 16 bits of EAX. You modify BX, that's the lower 16 bits of EBX. And they also extended all the previously special registers. So EBP, ESI are these 32-bit versions of those 16-bit registers. And so then around a little after 2000, AMD said, we want a 64-bit version of this, and also 8 registers, that's not very many. Like, we really like to have more registers. By the time, over the 90s, people discovered that, it's not so great to have a processor design with only 8 registers, given how we were designing processors. We wanted to access memory less than we were before. So they wanted to have 16 registers. So AMD did 2 things. So they extended all these registers to have 64 bits. So they extended them again. And they decided not to write EE for extended, but instead they wrote R, just for register. And they also added 8 more. So you ended up with a picture of this, like this. So they extended EAX into RAX. So RAX is now 64 bits. The lower 32 bits of it are EAX, and so on. And they added register 8 through 15. They just decided, we're not going to make up special names for the registers, and we're not going to try to continue this, DX, EX, FX, and so on. So they just named them R8 through R15. And because it was convenient to operate on only 32-bit values sometimes, like you want to add to 16-bit or 32-bit numbers, they provided a way to access the lower 32 bits of these new registers, the lower 16 bits of these new registers. And they also provided a way to access the lower 8 bits of all the registers. So they have R8B is the lower 8 bits of R8, and BPL, which they added, is the lower 8 bits of BP, which previously wasn't a thing you could do. And doing this, makes these registers more similar to each other, so there's less cases where you can only do things with AX, BX, or CX. Because for the most part, the registers are the same. The only special case is AH, and I see I made a typo here. Which I didn't notice, and I should write BH and CH and DH are the only special cases anymore, and we won't use them very often at all. Probably if you're writing assembly code by hand or reading assembly code written by the compiler, it won't ever touch those top halves of those first registers. So those are our basic registers. So if you remember IBCM, the accumulator was the register that our operations used, but we had a few extras like the program counter, and there are going to be a few extras in x86-64. But before I move on, any questions about these registers? Okay. So registers I didn't talk about. So there are a whole nother set of registers for floating point that we will probably not look at all, but they exist. They have names like ST0 and XMM0. There's a register for the program counter, and this is called RIP, EIP, or IP. RIP being the 64-bit version, EIP being the 32-bit version, and so on. But most instructions, you can't access this register directly. You might occasionally see it used, but you can only use it in special cases. There's registers for flags, which are used by conditional jumps. So x86 does conditional jumps different than what we saw in IBCM. In IBCM, we had this instruction which compared values, and then based on that, set the PC. In x86, we're going to have an instruction to compare values, which is going to set these flags. And then we're going to have a separate instruction which uses the flag set by the comparison to set the PC. There's also a bunch of extra registers if you're implementing an operating system for things like did a seg fault occur, that sort of thing, that we're not going to ever touch. So that's our registers. So despite this like extra complication of registers, our instruction execution is basically the same. We fetch from our program counter, which if you remember, this is called RIP, is the name that you might see in assembly sometimes for this. Then we execute the instruction that we fetch, and if it didn't change the PC itself, we add the length of that instruction to it. So in IBCM, we just always added one because all our instructions were one memory location. In x86, it turns out the encoding of instructions is variable. So you have to configure out the length. So you're sometimes going to add one, sometimes going to add more, depending on how many bytes it takes to write the machine code. That's the same idea. So another thing which is very similar is declaring constants. So this is the NASM syntax. So there's some things which are a bit different. So one thing that you'll see is that we have this section declaration. So this is not strictly necessary. So we have section.data and section.text. So data is, this is where put the memory for data. And the tech.text says memory for code. You might wonder why is it not .code or .machine code, but it isn't. So this section declaration says, when you're producing an executable from this, I want this in the part of memory you're using mostly for data. Versus, I want this in the part of memory using mostly for code. Notably, the memory that's used for data, you can write to. The memory that's used for code, often you can't. If you try to write to it, you'll get a seg fault. And then we have similar declarations. We have a label, and we can have do something like DW for declare word, and we can put in a value. So we have several versions of this in NASM. We have declare B, byte, DB, declare word. A word in NASM is 16 bits. This is another history thing. So our registers are typically 64 bits. You might say, didn't you say it was the natural size? So it should be 64. But remember that we have this history where we started off with these 16-bit registers. That's where the name word was chosen for x86. So often in x86 documentation, when they refer to a word, they mean a 16-bit value because they decided on that term in like 1978. And that's true of NASM. They're using terms from the late 70s, early 80s. So we have DD is a 4-byte constant, D for double word. That's what a 32-bit value is if your 16-bit values are words. And they have DQ for quad word for a 64-bit constant. So some things you can do, you're allowed to put a question mark to indicate I don't care what this is. And you're allowed to specify multiple values together, in which case it will be 1 followed by 2 followed by 3. This is an array of values. And you can also do this syntax here, which is the same as 0, 0, 0, specifying 8 values. So this is how you can make allocate an array, in this case of size 8, and initialize it to 0. So you can do this to make a bigger array and so on without writing a whole, if you want an array of 100 items, you don't have to write 100 lines of, DW to declare that array or something like that.
If you want to declare that as an array, you just use the comma separated, you do times 8 and then just the comma separated numbers.
If you wanted to declare this, so times 8 says I want DB0 8 times.
Okay.
If you want, so if you do the comma separated numbers, presumably you, I'm not sure whether NASM supports it or not, but if it does, I'd assume it would mean like if you did times 8 DB1 comma 2, you'd be specifying DB1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and so on.
So X is an array in this case, right?
So X is, yeah, an array of, yeah, of values in this case. Okay. So you see that we have labels like what you've written in ICBCM, where we put them at the beginning of the line and just write it. So NASM allows labels where you just write it at the beginning of the line, like we've seen before, or it allows you to add a colon. So every other assembler I know for XD6 generally requires the colon, and I strongly recommend it, primarily for the reason that what if you choose a label name that's an instruction name? So XD6 has a ridiculous number of instructions, like literally over 1,000. Just different instruction names. And if you use a colon, it says unambiguously that this is not an instruction, this is actually just a label, even if it's the same as an instruction name. And this is only a labels when actually specifying where the label is, not using it. Using it, you never don't use a colon, you just write like jump label name. And in the other assembler, which we're mentioning primarily because you might see the compiler use it, the output, the syntax for declaring variable for declaring constants is a bit different. Got a colon here, which is required. But sort of uses similar notions, like they have long and quad for quad word again, still. Sort of made up these names in the early 80s, late 70s. Okay, so that's sort of my, what are the registers, what are they named, and what does sort of our assembly labels and declaring constants look like? So let's start talking about instructions in our remaining 3 minutes and look at our first instruction, move. So move, we have a destination and a source, and it copies the value from the source into the destination. And our destination and source can be a register, so any of those register names I showed you earlier. I'm gonna try to write them in all caps, but it's case insensitive, so you can write lowercase rax or uppercase rax, either way. You can write a constant, like a hexadecimal value or a decimal value. You might sometimes see 1234H, which is the same as OX1234 as a constant. You can write a label name to indicate the address of the label. And you can specify a memory location by using brackets. So if I specify brackets OX1234, that means the value in memory at the address 1234. If I specify OX1234, that means the constant 1234. If I specify brackets RAX, that means I'm using RAX as a pointer. You don't have to like write an instruction to do that anymore. You just say, use RAX as a pointer by doing that. And there's a special rule, there's one type of move instruction, which even though these are all the operands we support, which doesn't exist, and that's for moving from memory to memory. Well, yeah, if you want to do that, you can't use this instruction. You have to do something like move it to a register and then move it from the register back to memory. You can't specify memory address for both operands of the move instruction. You can specify it for either one, but not both. And obviously you can't specify a constant as the destination. That is not permitted. Yes?
Would this be like load and store in IBCM?
Question is, would this be like load and store in IBCM? Yes, so this instruction will do both what load does and what store does. So like IBCM load 42 is kind of like move RAX comma 42. Within brackets. And store 42 is kind of like move into 42 in brackets RAX. Say kind of because like we have to specify a register. I'm going to always use RAX as my default register for everything because it's the first one. But that's basically it. Okay. So next time we're to go over more instructions and more details about operands for instructions. We're going to first go over what move instruction looks like in general because the same patterns for what the operands can be will apply to most instructions. So most of the instructions in x86 take the same kinds of operands as move.